The United States has no designs whatsoever on Southeast Asia or any country in it.
Men who covet the earth cannot be reasoned with over a coffee table.
The American Broadcasting Company presents ABC Special Report, Dialogue and Decision. A review of American policy in Vietnam. A look at the criticism of it, the alternatives to it. This is ABC Special Report. And now your narrator, ABC News correspondent Ted Koppel.
The criticism is varied, vociferous, and seemingly endless. The critics are varied, vociferous, and seemingly countless. Professors, students, legislators, clergymen, writers and painters, veterans groups and garden groups, spokesmen for the right, spokesmen for the left. The criticism stems from men with little in common but the very fact that they are critical. And it is all being directed at one government, led by one administration, led in turn by one man, Lyndon Baines Johnson. It would appear that the primary question in many minds is whether that one man will go down in history as the savior of democracy or the co-signer of mankind's demise. It would appear that the next question in many minds is, what are we fighting for in Vietnam and why?
It is not enough to just fight against something. People must fight for something. It is therefore our task to show that freedom from the control of other nations offers the surest road to progress. We must show it through action, and we must show it through accomplishment. We will not abandon our commitment to South Vietnam.
It can be argued that each American president is, to a certain extent, the prisoner of his predecessor's commitments. Our commitment to South Vietnam began during the Eisenhower administration, unfolded during the Kennedy administration, and remains under President Lyndon Johnson to be resolved. The responsibility for how it will be resolved lies with the president. But under democracy's prerogative, the president will receive advice, solicited and unsolicited, from all quarters. Each statement of policy from the White House prompts a new rash of questions and protests. Each such new outburst eventually brings yet another policy clarification. Defense Secretary Robert McNamara at a Washington news conference the 16th of June, 1965.
The United States has no designs whatsoever on the territory or the resources of Southeast Asia or any country in it. The ultimate goal of our country, therefore, in Southeast Asia is to help maintain free and independent nations there in which the people can develop politically, economically, and socially according to patterns of their own choosing and with the objective of becoming responsible members of the world family of nations. Our strategy is to convince the North Vietnamese that their communist-inspired, directed, and supported guerrilla action to overthrow the established government in the South cannot be achieved.
Broadly speaking, this represents a summation of what has been and is currently the administration's program in Vietnam. A two-pronged policy that seeks to combine an outward display of strength along with an ever-ready willingness to negotiate. This, at least, is the administration's overt policy. And as far as it goes, it has been relatively immune to criticism. But opponents to the Johnson policy in Southeast Asia see the administration operating on a second, covert level. Senator Wayne Morse, Democrat of Oregon.
This administration has concealed time and time again the facts about its operation in Southeast Asia from the American people. And that's why there is a rising tide of protests in this country against the Johnson War in Southeast Asia.
One of the original Senate opponents to the so-called Johnson War is the man whom Senator Morse calls his mentor, Alaska Democrat, Senator Ernest Greening.
We were the people who asked us to ask ourselves to come in and defend them. We so-called advisors that we went in there pretty soon proved to be anything but advisors. They were pretty soon engaged in combat.
Many believe that this is perhaps the Johnson administration's most vulnerable point. On June 23, 1964, President Johnson expressed this thought for the first of many times.
The United States intends no rashness. And the United States seeks no wider war.
The day before, General Paul Harkins, U.S. commander in Vietnam, said, it would be worth risking war with China to save South Vietnam from a communist takeover. 16,000 American servicemen were then in Vietnam. 1 month later, on July 24th, the President of the United States said this.
It is true that there is danger and provocation from the North, and such provocation could force a response. But it is also true that the United States seeks no wider war.
2 weeks later, President Johnson ordered the bombing of communist coastal supply facilities in North Vietnam in retaliation for a communist attack on a U.S. destroyer in the Gulf of Tonkin. The date, August 4th, 1964.
We Americans know, although others appear to forget, the risk of spreading conflict. We still seek no wider war.
Some 2 months later, U.S. forces in Vietnam approached the 20,000 mark. Military commanders predicted the ultimate defeat of the communists, and on October 16th, the President of the United States said,
"We seek no wider war, but we are prepared and we intend to preserve and to protect and to defend the United States of America."
February 1965. American dependents are ordered withdrawn from Vietnam. U.S. and South Vietnamese air elements directed to launch joint retaliatory attacks against communist barracks and staging areas in the north. February 14th, the most massive air attack yet. And the President of the United States again said,
"We seek no wider war, but we must all understand that we will persist in the defense of freedom."
April 1965. Two battalions of U.S. Marines ordered to Vietnam the previous month. U.S. forces now number 27,000. The administration proposes $1 billion of American aid for Southeast Asia. Secretary of State Dean Rusk rejected suggestions to end airstrikes against the North, and the President of the United States said,
"America has not changed her essential position, and that purpose is peaceful settlement. That purpose is to resist aggression. That purpose is to avoid a wider war."
Less than a month later, in May, U.S. strength rose to nearly 46,000. And now, July of 1965, the number totals more than 70,000. As one wag noted, "We may not be seeking a wider war, but it sure is getting a hell of a lot deeper." Many critics feel that President Johnson says one thing and does the other. But it would be naive to expect that President Johnson's critics might be silenced, even if the president outlined his policies openly and with detailed candor. Senator Morse, for one, is opposed to the very war itself.
"I don't think we can ever win this war. We can win many, many military engagements, but eventually the United States will be kicked out of Asia."
There are those, indeed, who go one step further and ask, what are we doing in that part of the world in the first place? Which, come to think of it, is a valid question. America's involvement in Vietnam began modestly enough. While the French fought the Viet Minh in what was then known as Indochina, they were aided by American supplies. Following the French defeat at Dien Bien Phu and the signing of the Geneva Treaty in 1954, the United States continued its material support to the anti-communist South Vietnamese. Under the Geneva Accord, Vietnam was subjected to a Korea-like split, the North divided from the South at the 19th parallel. Communist infiltration grew in South Vietnam. As that infiltration increased, so too did American support for the government. During the Eisenhower administration, U.S. military advisors were first sent to Vietnam to instruct government forces in the use of American weapons. Under President Kennedy, American troops first went into action alongside Vietnamese soldiers, but they were in the field strictly as advisors, with orders to fire only when fired upon. Officially, it was not until a few weeks ago that the administration admitted that American field commanders had the authority to send their men into combat. And as we've noted, it was not until within the past year that American planes began their bombing sorties over North Vietnam, or that U.S. naval vessels shelled the Vietnamese coast. So much for the escalation of the war. But still, why are we there in the first place? The charge that the United States is merely picking up where the French left off was answered incisively by former Vice President Richard M. Nixon.
"The French were fighting in Indochina to stay in. We are fighting in Vietnam to get out."
Why, then, is it so difficult to get out? In a word, dominoes. Southeast Asia has been likened to a row of dominoes, each leaning upon the next. As the theory goes, if the first one falls, they all fall. In the political context, the United States has decided to make its stand, lend its support to Vietnam. to shore up the Vietnamese dam against the communist tide so that Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, Burma, and Malaysia will not fall to the communists in quick succession. The broad reasoning behind U.S. policy is that sooner or later we have got to make a stand in Southeast Asia, or eventually the red tide will reach the Philippines, India, and Pakistan, and possibly even Japan. Should that ever come to pass, all of Asia would effectively be under communist control. William Bundy, Assistant Secretary of State for Far Eastern Affairs, put it this way.
If you can do the job in Asia and avoid the threat to India and other areas that communist domination of Southeast Asia would represent, you will have a much less difficult job to do. The sooner you get at this, the better. Otherwise, you will have to face it further down the line and at greater cost.
But there is also the matter of America's moral commitment. Senator William J. Fulbright, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
I am opposed to an unconditional American withdrawal from South Vietnam because such action would betray our obligation to people we have promised to defend, because it would weaken or destroy the credibility of American guarantees to other countries, and because such a withdrawal would encourage the view in Peking and elsewhere that guerrilla wars supported from outside are a relatively safe and inexpensive way of expanding communist power.
Then, too, the point is made that we're in too far now to turn back, that we've long ago passed the point of no return. On the 22nd of last March, Senator Ernest Greening, during a policy debate with presidential adviser McGeorge Bundy, addressed himself to that argument.
Now, I grant you that it's much more difficult for us to get out of the mess we're in now than it would have been a year ago. But I still think we should make every effort to stop the killing. And the first thing we should do is, for the time being at least, to stop the bombing of North Vietnam.
Persistent criticism of U.S. bombing raids against North Vietnam had their effect. This past April, the administration ordered a lull that lasted almost a week. During that time, no bombs were dropped on North Vietnam. Using British diplomats as intermediaries, Washington tried to negotiate with Hanoi. There was no response. U.N. Ambassador Adlai Stevenson.
We have made numerous quiet diplomatic efforts to reach Hanoi in the hope of encouraging new negotiations. Various friendly nations have tried to convey this message to North Vietnam, but there has been no response. The silence is deafening.
The administration has clearly interpreted Hanoi's silence as a vindication of what official Washington has maintained all along. McGeorge Bundy.
There are a great many people in this country who really believe that the bear will turn into a golden retriever if we treat him that way. It's not so.
The administration is in something of a damned if we do, damned if we don't dilemma. Criticized on the one side by those who feel America has gone too far in Vietnam, President Johnson is also subjected to attack by those who feel we haven't gone far enough. Barry Goldwater, addressing a young Republican convention on June 16th.
The president, for all too long, permitted it to become an accepted fact that we would not bomb the crucial industrial complex in and around Hanoi itself. That, I suggest, is nothing less than giving the enemy a privileged sanctuary. And I support and urge the prompt withdrawal of that promise of sanctuary.
Former Vice President Nixon explains his agreement with that line of reasoning.
I've been to Hanoi, and it, like any other major city, has a downtown district. It has residential districts immediately around it, and then it has factory areas, oil installations, and others. I think that the oil installations and those factories that are producing for military purposes should be targets. I do, however, oppose the bombing of what I would call strictly civilian areas.
The bombing of Hanoi, however, even to the exclusion of civilian areas, would represent yet another escalation in the war with North Vietnam. There are even some fears that it might draw Red China into the war. Again, the senator from Arkansas, William Fulbright.
These things can get out of hand very easily, and I think there's a great danger of either a Korean-type war or that all going on further into a world war.
Former Vice President Nixon has also considered the possibility of Red Chinese intervention. He regards it with a certain amount of fatalism.
I think we've got to make it very clear to the Red Chinese that there will be no Yellow River concept in the event they intervene in this war in force, either through men or through planes. If China, Red China, has the audacity and I think the foolishness to intervene in this war, then the United States will have no choice but to hit vital targets in Red China. I don't think they want that.
The mere thought of further escalation, though, is a persistent source of alarm to men like Vermont Senator George Aiken.
It's getting very late. It looks as if we were perhaps headed for the brink at a faster pace than ever.
The debate over Vietnam is one of the few important issues in this country that appears to cross party lines indiscriminately. Some of President Johnson's harshest critics are members of his own party. Some of his firmest supporters are members of the opposition. Senator William Fulbright, a Democrat, falls into neither category. Fulbright represents, perhaps more than any other man, the position of moderation.
Our policy, therefore, has been and should remain one of determination to end the war at the earliest possible time by a negotiated settlement involving major concessions by both sides.
Senate Minority Leader Everett Dirksen, possibly the second most powerful politician in the United States.
Any who talk of concessions by the United States have an obligation to specify the kinds of concessions which they are prepared to advocate.
Senator Frank Church of Idaho.
Well, I think that we ought not to pursue a single-minded course of action in Vietnam, that we ought to actively explore the possibilities for an alternative course. I think that we should begin to actively examine the prospects for a political settlement which would neutralize South Vietnam and perhaps Laos and Cambodia as well under an arrangement that would guarantee the boundaries of these countries and permit the withdrawal of foreign forces from both sides.
The administration has never ruled out the alternative of a negotiated settlement. But Secretary of State Dean Rusk has pointed out the inherent pitfalls of such a settlement.
Political channels have been and are open to explore the possibilities of a peaceful solution. A negotiation which simply ends in bitterness and hostility merely adds to the danger.
Nevertheless, on May 13th of this year, President Johnson acknowledged the inevitability of negotiation in the Vietnamese war, and he went one step further.
We know, as our adversaries should also know, that there is no purely military solution in sight for either side. We are ready for unconditional discussion.
Behind the president's reasoning apparently is the conclusion that sooner or later, American forces will have to withdraw from Southeast Asia. It would seem inconceivable that the United States will keep a substantial military contingent on permanent duty wherever the specter of communism exists. Ideally, our policy is a preparatory one. America prepares the way for home rule. No one is arguing that the South Vietnamese government should not be allowed to run its own affairs or even fight its own war. But the question is, what South Vietnamese government? Senator Frank Church uses this as his primary point of contention with the administration in Washington.
I don't think that there is any way that the United States can furnish a stable government in Saigon. And we'd better recognize that right now. That's up to the Vietnamese themselves. If they can unite together and manage to establish and maintain a stable government for a sufficient length of time to enable that government to prosecute the war, then there are chances that the war itself can be won in South Vietnam. But this is strictly up to the Vietnamese. It's their war to be won or to be lost. There is no way that we can substitute ourselves in their place and win their war for them.
Senator George McGovern of South Dakota has expanded on the same point.
It is not our mission to play policeman for the world. In the long run, only the people of Southeast Asia can decide the political ideology under which they will live.
Senator McGovern has said it one way. Senator Barry Goldwater said it another.
I don't believe that the expanded use of American ground troops is an effective addition to this war. The proper ground forces for use in Vietnam are those of our other allies in the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization. Our contribution should be the full and proper use of air power and sea power.
And yet another variation on the same theme from the former Vice President of the United States, Richard Nixon.
Tito alliance is no longer useful because its primary power was based on the European partners. What is needed now is for the Asian nations themselves to develop their alliance. And they should set up a military alliance, which we should then assist economically as we assist the European alliance, or assisted it in the outset. By having such a military alliance, then that will tend to contain communist Chinese aggression without having the United States have that major responsibility when it breaks out someplace else.
But while CETO exists and while our commitment to Southeast Asia continues, the United States is saddled with that responsibility. And despite the apparent incongruity of seeking no wider war while American ground troops are being sent simultaneously in ever-increasing numbers to Vietnam, President Johnson is obviously striving to avoid an all-out Asian war. Speaking at the 20th anniversary celebration of the United Nations, Mr. Johnson reflected on the frustration of trying to make peace with an enemy who, in the president's words, refuses to come and reason together.
The processes of peaceful settlement today are blocked by willful aggressors, contemptuous of the opinion and the will of mankind. Bilateral diplomacy has yielded no result. An appeal for unconditional discussion was met with contempt. A pause in bombing operations was called an insult. The concern for peace of the Commonwealth prime ministers has received little and very disappointing results.
Thus, according to President Johnson, efforts to seek a peaceful solution in Vietnam have been and apparently are still being made. The results, obviously, are intangible. Under this nation's current policy, the United States cannot, and it seems will not, pull out of Vietnam. Therefore, the question does not appear to be stay in or get out, but rather stay in or get in further. The critics, meanwhile, are voluble, but if the polls provide an accurate standard, still in the minority. According to the latest Lou Harris polls, 65% of the American people approve of the manner in which the Vietnam policy is being handled. Those who disapprove are more than holding up their end of the spirited dialogue that has swept America. Whatever the outcome of that dialogue, the decisions rest, as always, with the one man whom President Truman pictured as sitting where the buck stops. This is Ted Koppel for ABC News.
ABC Special Report, Dialogue and Decision. Written by Ted Koppel and Edward Hanna. Produced by Edward Hanna, production assistant Peter Katz. Director, Ray Campbell. Audio engineering by Jack McCarthy and Bob Walters. Executive producer, Tom O'Brien. Your narrator was Ted Koppel.